Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday morning. Youth Haiti is our subject the first hour of the program. It is a remarkable organization, Milwaukee-based actually, that focuses on developing ecological sanitation options and sustainable food sources through composting toilets, community gardens, community education, and more. This hour of the program, we're going to be speaking with the founder of Youth Haiti, and with two young gentlemen who are from Haiti who've been involved with this program. And our guests are Gigi Pomerantz is a nurse practitioner from Milwaukee who visited Haiti for the first time in February on 2006 on a medical mission. She saw starving children. She saw gardens struggling to produce vegetables from the soils depleted by erosion. And, of course, since that time, Haiti has had a horrendous earthquake and many more problems. She met with the health leaders in the village of Dushiti and learned of the need for sanitation because many people had no sanitation in that area. And she also learned about methods of ecological sanitation used in Africa and in Asia. They now have composting toilets, a community garden, and the program is expanding. She is joining us in our Milwaukee studio. Gigi, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And also joining us, we have two young gentlemen from Haiti. Gilles is here, who is now the local national coordinator for this project, and he works for the Ministry of Communication. He is from Port-au-Prince. Thank you very much, Gilles, for being with
thank
us.
Thank you very much, also.
Also joining us is Francie, who doesn't speak a great deal of English, but we do welcome you, Francie, to the program. I'm sorry that you can't be talking a lot with us, but we welcome. Thank you very much for being with us. We're going to welcome phone calls from our audience, as we always do. I know that when we do programs on Haiti, I'm amazed how much work is being done by people in Wisconsin in Haiti, so you may indeed already be familiar with Gigi's program. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Gigi, tell me about the first trip that you made, which obviously entered your mind and your heart and everything because you've done this remarkable project. What did you see? Why did you do this program?
Well, when I first went as a nurse practitioner on this medical mission, I really had no idea what to expect. I prepared myself for the visit by studying tropical medicine and being prepared to see patients. But as a nurse practitioner, my emphasis has always been on prevention, and so a part of what I saw was an opportunity to do prevention. That first trip, we were four providers, and we saw 1,400 patients.
Oh my goodness!
In 4.5 days. It was quite overwhelming. I saw children literally starving to death. But we treated all 1,400 people, plus many more on the street, for worms. Every single person that came in got treated for worms. And about 50% of the people had complaints of diarrhea, stomach pain, poor appetite, GI complaints. So I began to see the real need for sanitation. I mean, it became very real to me, the impact of the lack of sanitation.
Mm-hmm. And you subsequently have formed this organization, Youth Haiti. Just give us more information about what you're doing and the collaboration with the youth in Dushiti.
So I'll just back up a little bit to give you kind of the timeline. So after that first visit, as I was thinking about how could we address this problem, I had read about these methods of ecological sanitation, and I started to correspond with Francie in French. And I said, what do you think about building some toilets in the village? And he's like, yeah, let's do that. And I said, we can't do this alone, just you and me talking about it. You need to put together an organization on the ground. And I didn't realize that he was the youth leader in the church. And so that's how the youth part developed. It started with young people. We originally had a group of about 27 young people in an organization called OJPDD, Organisation des Jeunes Progressistes pour le Développement de Dushiti, which is Progressive Youth for the Development of Dushiti. That group has now grown to over 80 young people. And in Haiti, when you talk about youth, you're not talking about young children. We're talking about young adults, basically. So they're 18 to 30. Many of whom are still in high school. But it's an educated population for the most part, and very interested in seeing their community and their country develop.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a great opportunity for partnership.
Gilles, let me ask you before we talk about the Youth Haiti program. I'm interested to know how life is in Port-au-Prince right now, because it fades from view here in America after the worst is over. Are many people still struggling?
Okay, in Port-au-Prince now, as you know, after the earthquake, Port-au-Prince is a city there is no a good functionment in Port-au-Prince now. Many tents and many people in the street lives in the street. Now the public palace not exist now. Port-au-Prince try to keep, but it's difficult to live in Port-au-Prince now. We think with the new government, new president, I don't know, but the situation will be good now. It's not interesting to live in Port-au-Prince now.
Mm-hmm. And I think I read something that you had written, Gigi, that many people are still afraid children to sleep inside buildings. Some of them may be structurally sound, but they have nightmares about what has happened, so they're still sleeping in what they may call tents, but they're very insubstantial structures on the streets.
Right, right. I mean, Port-au-Prince is really still quite a disaster. They say there's still about 700,000 people living under tents. At the height, there were 1.5 million. Where the other 800,000 have gone is still a little bit unclear. Some have gone back to the countryside. Some are living with their families in some other kind of structure. Some people are now going back into unsound buildings just because the so-called tents have fallen apart. You know, they're not keeping the rain out and the mud, and there's no sanitation to meet the needs of all those people.
And when there is no sanitation, what health problems ensue?
Well, the baseline problems of diarrhea of various kinds is the major thing that happens with lack of sanitation. And, of course, in Haiti since last October, there's been a cholera epidemic. It's now been documented that it was introduced by a Nepalese UN contingent, not purposefully, I'm certain, but nonetheless. And poor sanitation practices on the part of the UN in their base resulted in them dumping waste into a river that was used by thousands of people, both for bathing, for washing, and for water sourcing.
Mm-hmm.
That epidemic has now made, I believe it's 500,000 people ill, and 5,000 people have died.
Mm.
All throughout the country, it's quite amazing. I mean, it didn't stay in one area. It traveled the entire length of the country.
And did a number of people move? Tell us where Dushiti is. It's far from Port-au-Prince,
yes,
but people have moved from Port-au-Prince to safer ground?
Some people, after the earthquake, a lot of people left to get to safer places. But little by little, people have kind of wandered back towards Port-au-Prince. And that's very discouraging to me, and it's one of the reasons why I focus our programs on the countryside to create both job opportunities and capacity building outside of the city, which is so overcrowded. Port-au-Prince is a city that was designed for 250,000 people, and there were over 2.5 million people living there at the time of the earthquake. So it can't sustain that kind of pressure and be functioning well.
Mm-hmm. Have you spent your life in Port-au-Prince, Gilles?
I was in Port-au-Prince last 1912, before I was in Kai, a city in Haiti. I leave Kai to Port-au-Prince. I was in school, in university. I have 11 years in Port-au-Prince. I see the situation since
1912. 1992.
Okay, 1992.
Okay. I didn't think it was 1912, yeah. But none of us would be here if it were that long ago.
Okay, 1992, excuse
okay,
me.
Okay, that's fine.
Life in Puerto Press, when I said you last time, we try to live now. We try to live. We hope in a best life with the new president, the new government, a new orientation for the situation. But life is so-so. Not so-so. Well, not yeah. Well, not well, not bad.
Where were you when the earthquake struck?
Huh?
Where were you when the earthquake?
Oh, inside my house.
In your house?
In house, at home.
His house apparently was not destroyed. Still standing, and he's still living in the same house.
It's amazing. So,
yeah.
Please give us some historical background. I keep hearing reports, and you are a case in point, of how industrious and lovely the people who live in Haiti are, that it's just this, and people who do your work say that they feel so welcome. They're showered with gifts from people who have nothing, and it's just mm-hmm. this wonderful, wonderful place. Why has Haiti had such a hard time of it? Why is it so poor? Why is there a lack of sanitation? How did all this happen?
You have to really look back historically. So Haiti is the first free black nation in the world and the second free republic in the Western Hemisphere. It took its independence from France in a slave rebellion that lasted for 14 years. In 1804, they finally were able to kick the French out. Excuse me. And so at that point, several things happened. The slaves, you can imagine how angry they were, destroyed all of the prosperity that the French had built on their backs. So all of the plantations and everything were burned, coffee plantations and sugarcane plantations, to get rid of kind of the onus of slavery. But so then they were starting from scratch with an uneducated population. But on top of that, most of the world would not recognize a freed slave state. And so for the first 20 years of their existence, they really struggled until 1824, the French said, well, if you pay us reparations for the loss of our property, meaning the slaves themselves, and they counted each head, each man, woman, and child, and levied a tax, they said then they would start to trade with them and recognize them in the world of nations. And so they asked them for $90 million in 1824, and that's equivalent to something like $22 billion or perhaps more today. Haiti paid it. It took them over 100 years to pay it.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that story.
Yes. Ooh. So that's what put them in debt from the very beginning. One of the ways that they paid it or started paying it was by cutting down the hardwood and selling the wood. And so that was the beginning of the deforestation. Now, the deforestation has continued with the use of wood for charcoal, which is the main fuel source. So the country became economically depleted and then also ecologically depleted, kind of going hand in hand. Mm. It's been a very rough time.
Maybe people need to go back to France and say, hey, you've done us wrong. Give us some money.
Oh, Aristide did that. Caused him a lot of trouble.
I can say yet after the people make the charcoal for ruin the money. Okay, mm-hmm. It's a problem for deforestation. Mm-hmm. If we had money, if we had a good politic for the money for the richest, for the richest creation in Haiti, the people does not need to. To make the charcoal, to destroy the woods, the trees, for making the charcoal for the money. Now, we want a new politic of money in Haiti. We need employed. We need jobs creations, mm-hmm. For wind money in Haiti now.
For wind.
To make money.
I thought maybe you were talking about wind power. Right. And what kinds of jobs do you see as possible?
A job politic, because in any situation, for example, sanitation we can create job in it, sanitation, ecological. We can replant the trees in the mountains. Okay? Mm-hmm. Infrastructure. I don't know if you understand the word infrastructure.
Infrastructure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can create job. Yeah. Many, in many situations, we can create a job for the people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
And what about alternative fuels? This must be part of what you're interested in too, Gigi. To keep the trees from being cut down, you use what instead?
Right. Well, we've looked at some projects that, and actually Bill Clinton was promoting, before the earthquake, was promoting a project to make briquettes out of garbage, recycled basically paper products where they would make them into briquettes, compact them, and burn them for fuel instead of charcoal. I've met with an agronomist in Lakai, the largest city that's near Dushiti, who's making briquettes out of agricultural waste, like the leftovers of corn husks, and I don't know what else. So these are opportunities for creating both employment and saving the environment. But any project like that needs investment. One of the things Haiti needs probably the most is people to invest in different kinds of projects. I saw, on YouTube, a process developed by some Japanese guy, so I don't know where he is now, but to take waste plastic, like your plastic, and reconvert it into oil that could be used for kerosene or whatever to cook with. I thought, this is a fascinating thing. Who's got the money to invest in it? Bring a giant plant to Haiti to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it needs investors, people who are willing to take a chance on a country that's struggled so long. But the people are industrious and want to be able to work.
So who's willing to take that chance?
That's
are we doing
question.
That? Is the United States taking that chance?
No. I mean, I wouldn't say so. even the money that's been pledged hasn't all been forthcoming. We just read yesterday that the Clinton-Bush Fund, which raised money, after the earthquake and has all these funds, they just put $2 million into building a luxury hotel. So not into helping people build homes and invest in home building, not into building an industry that might create something sustainable, but a luxury hotel.
Who's going to stay at the – who'd they build it for?
Well, I think their idea, from what I read, is that they need a luxury hotel to bring investors to Haiti.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Right,
catch
exactly.
22, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Because the people live in the street, in the street. Every day, many tents in the street in Haiti, you depend $2 million in a hotel.
Yeah.
To build a hotel.
I know. It doesn't make any sense, does it?
No.
I don't see the sense for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about Youth Haiti. And I do want to remind you, I think I'm saying it for the first time, that they're having an event Friday at 6 o'clock here in Milwaukee at the Milwaukee County Zoo, the Peck Welcome Center, if you want more information about Youth Haiti and have a chance to meet our guests who are here in the studio and learn more about their important work. Gigi Pomerantz is joining us. Gilles, who is the national coordinator, who is from Port-au-Prince, also with us. And Francie is also in our studios, doesn't speak much English, so it's hard to do an interview with Gilles, but we are happy that that Francie is with us as well. Gilles does speak English, as you can tell. All right, a couple lines are open. Feel free to join the conversation at 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, and we start with Joseph from Menasha. Hi, Joseph.
Hi. I was wondering if something was in the works for Haiti to draw tourists into that area. I know that landmass has Dominican Republic on there. I've been there, but I'm not real familiar with the rest of that landmass, but I know Dominican Republic has resources. They have people working. but a lot of what goes on there is drawn by tourists. So that means my question, kind of a 1-2 punch for Haiti, where they're trying to create jobs. They're also trying to get people to come to that area as a tourist. And that might be a ways off. I was just wondering if there was anything in the works for that. I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks, Joseph.
Before the earthquake, it was a very big push of at the end of the Préval administration. And, of course, the earthquake kind of put everything on hold. I know that the incoming president, Michel Martelly, has spoken about the importance of tourism. And so I would be very surprised if he doesn't make a push in that direction. I can say that there are some really beautiful places even now to go as a tourist. Most of the time when I go to visit Haiti, I go to the village and stay in the village. But in July when I was there, I had my first opportunity to actually go to a little resort that was absolutely stunning. Hotel room that was spotlessly clean, air-conditioned, hot water showers, and great food and clean white beaches. So those places still do exist. Excuse me. Many people feel like they can't go to Haiti and do that when there's so much destruction still left. But it is one of the things that Haiti needs badly, is people to recognize it as a tourist destination again.
Mm-hmm. Gilles, would you agree that would be a good way to develop the economy?
Yeah. For development economic in Haiti now, we need employment. We need to in a good situation to make money, because the people live on less than $1 by day. It's a big problem for us.
Mm-hmm.
I wish the new government think to create employment, think to solve or resolve some problems about ecological, because the deforestation is a big problem for us now. If you create some employment with to reap the trees in the mountains, we need to use many people for that.
Yes.
For example, you can give 1,000 people employ,
mm-hmm.
Jobs,
mm-hmm.
create job. It's our problem now. If they want to solve some problems in Haiti to make money now, we think in deforestation, agriculture, because Haiti was the richest country in the Caribbean. Yeah, now we are the poorest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We go to Kenneth in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, Kenneth.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Just fine. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in 94 down there in Haiti. And the problem with the charcoal is the people can only afford a little amount of charcoal every day to cook their meals. They can't afford to buy a propane tank, you know, for 1,000 goud or 1,500 goud. They just don't have the money to buy that. So it's cheaper by half again than buying the charcoal. And if they reforest the country and kept the trees on the hills, they would come up so much faster. But they just can't do it.
So what do you see as the answer to that, Kenneth?
Well, I was when we were there, we were pulled out, and I was going to start a co-op where they would buy a tank, and they would come every day and give me, you know, 10 goud or 15 goud, and at the end they would have paid for that tank, and then they could get another one, and they would already have the money for that tank. That was what I was going to threaten them. So, and the jobs down there, they need jobs,
mm-hmm.
absolutely. And there's plenty of opportunities there because they live in an environment that can be really beautiful, you know, in other words, as far as growing crops and stuff like that. They don't grow crops all year round. They should. They don't. Because they have this mentality that you can only grow certain things at a certain time, you know. And it's not true. They can grow all year round.
Gigi, what about that, farming practices?
I haven't seen that they don't grow all year round. There's at least three growing seasons, but I think it's true that there a lot of the agriculture is limited by lack of education. In our program, we have our full-time staff person is an agronomist, and we brought him to Wisconsin to take a permaculture course, and he's now teaching permaculture practices. Permaculture is a method of basically small homestead gardening where you can use basically every inch of your property in a sustainable way, from collecting water to composting all of your waste, whether it be human waste or whether it be animal waste or garden waste, and feeding it back into the ground. You'll see a lot of slash and burn farming, which is a terrible way to deplete the soil. And so people need to be taught these other methods and demonstrated. So one of the things that we do with our composting toilets, we develop these demonstration gardens right near every dry composting toilet. So a dry composting toilet, if I can talk about that on air.
Of course, please.
Separates urine from feces. The urine is collected in a tank, and it's diluted 3-to-1 with water and used to make fertilizer.
Hmm.
We've seen tripling of the garden produce just using dilute urine as fertilizer for people who can't afford to buy chemical fertilizers. The solid waste is mixed with either ash or soil or other organic matter. It sits in a tank, and when the tank is full, it's sealed and sits for a full year to decompose. It kills all of the bad bacteria, all of the worms, and basically it becomes a, I don't want to say a sterile product, but a clean product that can be then applied to the soil also to increase the productivity. And when we first started, I thought that people would be really resistant to these ideas. And you know, when you go into a community, people kind of turn their noses up and laugh. And then you show them a jar of composted feces that smells like a garden floor or a forest floor. And they're like, maybe that would work.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to use it and they start to see
results.
And then
results. They find out it does work.
Yeah.
Is this something, that, are these practices widespread throughout developing countries in the world, or is it not?
They're used in various places throughout the world. There's many composting toilets in various places in Africa and in East Asia. But when I say all over the place, no, it's not as widespread as it should be. On the other hand, there's a large movement for ecological sanitation. We're members of a group called SUSANA, Sustainable Sanitation Association. And it's a worldwide group. We communicate with people from Europe and Asia. I don't know about South America, but there's Africans, all working on how to create models that are accessible to very poor people.
Mm-hmm. And what about the education component of this, Jill? How do you present the material so that these kinds of sustainable practices are embraced?
Material, you speak about material for the bird, the toilet?
No, for education.
For education. How do you let people in Haiti know this is the way to go? This is a good idea.
Oh, yeah. Many people think that. But there is many problems there now, but it's important to think about the priority. For example, if you want to develop the Haiti now, many problems, but there is some priority. For example, educations. Okay, educations have a new politic education to help the children in educations. Because the young man, the young become adult tomorrow.
Right.
Okay? For example, electricity. Now we need electricity because if with the light, many people can organize themselves, okay, to create some jobs, to prepare something in across the street. Many people can live good with electricity.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to address your question about how do we educate people. So we have trained the young people that we work with in this organization, OJPDD, to go out into the communities where we're touching and do community education. So when we put in a community toilet, we gather the whole community together, and we make a big celebration of it. And we'll fill a whole church full of the community, and we'll talk to them about, first of all, how to maintain this toilet, which, you know, if they haven't had one, they don't know how to keep it clean, or especially it's a special kind of toilet, separating the urine from the feces. We talk about the importance of hygiene, and we talk about how to use the products from the toilet. So we may have a nurse get up and speak about the importance of hygiene. We may have our agronomist come get up and speak about briefly about the utilization of the products in the garden. And then we'll send the agronomist back into the community to work directly with usually an organized group of community members. We also do education in the schools in this area. There's about 16 schools that we have a part-time staff that goes out several times a year teaching the children really mostly the importance of hygiene. You know, even in the developed world, people are pretty sloppy about washing their hands after using the bathroom. If you've ever gone into a public bathroom and watched what people do when they stop out, some people pass by the sink altogether. Some people turn the water on and flash their hands underneath it, and out they go, right? And none of that is really sufficient to keep your hands clean. But in our society, the risks are much less. In a society where you're doing agriculture, where there's many more endemic diseases, mm-hmm. the importance of actually washing your hands properly with soap and water, or if you don't have access to soap, using ash and friction, is really important. And people do need to be taught these things and reminded over and over and over again.
Thanks, Kenneth, for the call. We have a couple lines open if you want to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. Art in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Well, I want to thank Gigi and your other guests for all their work. It's wonderful. As you may know, I've done some work related to trying to normalize relations with Cuba and our 50-year trade embargo there. And my understanding is, in the background of Haiti's economic problems, is ever since Thomas Jefferson was really afraid of enslaved people freeing themselves beyond Haiti, that we were part of a economic blockade of Haiti for many years, all the way until our favorite president, Abraham Lincoln. So I'm wondering if you know anything about that. And secondly, in terms of the health crisis with cholera, et cetera, there, if you've had any experience or any knowledge of what Cuba's tried to do to try to help Haiti develop a better health care system.
So, hi, Art. How are you doing?
Good.
Nice to hear from you. In terms of the blockade, there's been, I think, several episodes where the U.S. has had trade embargoes against Haiti, and that has had a tremendous economic impact on the country. Every time that Haiti becomes economically isolated from the wider world, it's a country with limited resources. It makes it very difficult to survive. In terms of the role of Cuba, it's been quite remarkable. Even before the earthquake, Cuba had a medical presence in Haiti. As Cuba does throughout the developing world, they send their graduates to help in other countries. After the earthquake, they were among the first to establish relief centers. And since the cholera epidemic, I don't know the exact number, but I know they've set up dozens of cholera treatment units, which some of those have kind of scaled down now as the cholera epidemic has kind of waned a little bit, but they're expecting it to mount again with the rainy season. Mm. So, Cuba has done a lot in terms of help with medical services, and they have hundreds of Haitian students studying in Cuba as well.
And what about programs in the United States? Is your program unique, Gigi, or have church groups and community groups blossomed in this country to provide assistance to Haiti?
There's 10,000 NGOs in Haiti now.
10,000 NGOs. Oh, my goodness.
Many of which popped up after the earthquake. I don't know what percentage. I think more than 50% of those are new since the earthquake. It is quite remarkable. It's one of the things that I do like to stress is that we're not a result of the earthquake. We've been working in Haiti for 5 years. But there are a lot of people trying to do important work. However, because of this huge number, it's one of the reasons why we're in the process of establishing a local Haitian board and registering with the Haitian government, because there needs to be coordination. And with a new government coming in, we're hopeful that that will happen and that people will start to work together rather than one little project here, one little project there,
yes.
Everybody on their own.
Yeah. And you have both expressed, and Gilles, let me ask you about this. Optimism about the new government that's coming in. Why do you feel that way?
Okay. I think the new president, Michel Martelly, is an Haitian citizen. He loves his country. Now, I think Michel Martelly has some priority. I don't know, but I think that. I wish Michel Martelly work in educations, you know, is the first priority for him, mm-hmm. educations. Because education in Haiti is too expensive, you know. You need a lot of many money for in a university, in an university in Haiti. It's bad,
mm-hmm.
yeah. The university government, you need a many effort to enter in them. Every year, we have about 50,000 young to enter in a university, for example, but the government university can receive about 5,000.
Right.
You know,
so you need
it's
more
a great
access.
Problem.
Yeah.
No.
What encourages you about the incoming administration?
Well, I actually know Michel Martelly personally. He hosted us on a one trip that we made, which was quite an honor. I do think that he's coming in as a total political outsider. And there's a lot of scary things about that, but I think he's a smart man and he has learned to surround himself with people who have skill. He does say that education is a priority, and not just at the university level, but starting from the grade school level where there's no compulsory education and public education is very hard to come by. So I'm hopeful that there will be a change. He's also a very dynamic personality, and the outgoing president, Rene Préval, was not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the dynamism of his personality may carry things forward. He's got a big challenge ahead of him because he doesn't have any kind of majority in the legislature. And as we know well, even in this country, we can have a president with great ideas and a legislature that blocks everything along the way. So,
thank you, Art, for the call. We go next to Mike in Hales Corners. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I just wanted to remind folks that on Larry Mueller's program earlier this year, I believe, there was a program on, I believe it's called Engineers Without Borders, but mm-hmm. anyway, some young engineers, graduates of the University of Wisconsin, had put together one example of many of locally sourced manufacturing that could be done to utilize plant oils as a cooking deal. So essentially they can make stoves. They had designed a stove that can be made with scrap metal, essentially. So you have scrap sheet metal, and you follow their plans. You can put together these stoves. It doesn't require electricity, doesn't require plant or, you know, a manufacturing plant or whatever. It can be done in a village. And their main fuel source, what they're recommending for Haiti, because they were targeting Haiti, is to introduce the Jatropha plant, which is a plant native to equatorial India, Bangladesh, etc. And it is a very robust plant that's being used in those regions of the world, both as cooking fuels, to generate a cooking fuel, as well as to generate local biodiesel and so forth for their plants. It grows on marginal soils. You know, so it can go into those areas where you can't grow food crops. also is an excellent erosion prevention plant. But the idea here is what I really like about it, aside from it does present a solution for a country like Haiti, is that it's really taking an approach which is using intellectual knowledge, local materials, locally available manpower, and developing processes which are sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
Once the first money walks away and goes down the road, is that they've left behind a sustainable process that can be managed and maintained while you're developing your own intellectual base.
Gigi.
So I'm familiar with those, with Jatropha. I've done quite a bit of reading on it, and there are a few projects in Haiti that are looking at that. I don't see it as being widespread, at least at this point. I would say that culturally it's difficult to change people's practices. We did a little project using something called a rocket stove, which is also a stove you make from four cans. And it uses wood, but much, much less wood than you would use charcoal. So it was a great afternoon. We made all these stoves. I had bunches of kids around, and we were making them. And everybody took them home, and they used them for a day.
Mm.
You know, so getting people to change their practice is challenging. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible, but it does take continued introduction and education and working with people. Looking at the sustainability of projects is really important to us. And one of the things that we're launching right now is sanitation as a business project. Because if you look at worldwide, the number of people without sanitation, 2.6 billion people in the world, about a third of the world's population, does not have access to sanitation. And unfortunately, there's not enough donor dollars out there to provide all those people with toilets. And so models need to be developed that are sustainable. And addressing the issues that Gilles was saying about employment, if we can create a model where people are entrepreneurs and they can make money, and we can create a model that's affordable for the very poorest of the poor, then it's a win-win situation.
Thank you very much, Mike, for your call. Our phone number, a couple moments left to take phone calls, 800-486-8655. Gigi Pomeranz, president and founder of the Youth Haiti. By the way, you can go to their website, which is youthhaiti.org, is joining us in our studios in Milwaukee. And Gilles, who is the national coordinator for Youth Haiti, who is from Port-au-Prince, also joining us in our studios. Two more of your phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Wednesday, we'll talk again. It's been about a year since we've checked in with the people from the Encyclopedia of Life, which is this global partnership between the scientific community and the general public. The goal is to make readily available to anyone knowledge about all the world's organisms. And so far, it's 1.9 million named species. Obviously, in a project like this, you're going to find things you didn't even know existed, which is incredibly exciting. So that's going to be our number two of our program. 800-486-8655 is the number. June in Shawano is next. Hi, June.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
And hi to your guests. Bonjour, monsieur. I have several questions and one statement. I'll start with a statement. Before anyone from this country or other country goes to Haiti, they must respect the people of Haiti. I have lived in West Africa many years, and I know all about the people there, and this is where the people came from, the Igbo and the Yoruba tribes. Mm-hmm. And they brought with them much of their knowledge, slash and burn agriculture, which does refurnish the land. You have to have enough land to go to another plot, but it does. And they know their gardening or agriculture. They know what grows, they know the seasons, and it's good to respect their knowledge. My questions are, what does the OAS, if anything, do for the people of Haiti? And additionally, I'd like to add that my doctor, who is a physician who goes to Haiti, twice a year for two weeks, and she has been going there for a very long time, providing medical services to those there. And I think that's been the kind of work that one of your speakers has denigrated, but it's meant much to those people. Thank you.
Thank you, June, for the call.
So your question is, what does the OAS do? And I know they're there. They've been doing supervision of the elections. That's one of the things that they've been doing. OAS.
OAS. OAS is the company.
No, the Organization of American States. I don't know what's the acronym in French.
Organization
of American States.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
There we go.
Yeah.
So what did they do?
Supervision elections.
Yeah, that's
right. The last elections.
Yeah. I think it's mostly political type of work. I'm not familiar with what the development work is that they're doing.
She talked about her doctor who makes trips down there several times a year. Is that kind of help needed? I know there have been medical missions of American doctors and nurses going to Haiti, particularly during the earthquake time. Is that needed? Is that welcomed?
It's welcomed. It's needed until they can build their own system. After the earthquake, obviously, in the immediate emergency time, it was absolutely necessary. But also part of what happened as a result of that is they inundated a place that had kind of a minimal healthcare structure with this tremendous first world free medical care, and actually destroyed existing institutions, hospitals that were struggling to continue and keep their doors open and charge people money. No longer could provide service because people were looking to the volunteers for free care. It's a problem in all areas of development. If you give people free anything, they're not going to want to pay for something. It's one of the reasons why at some point after the earthquake, they were giving out a lot of rice. And Préval said, we have to stop giving away the rice because the people who are selling rice can't sell it. I don't want to argue that policy completely one way or the other. When you have millions of people under tents, you need to provide food for. But in the long run, and if you look at the global approach, you cannot continue to give things away. Again, it's one of the reasons why we're launching this sanitation as a business process, because we can't afford to give everything away, and then people are clamoring and don't want to pay for things, and then they don't create their own business, their own jobs and infrastructure. So it's a very delicate balance, even in terms of healthcare.
Right. Interesting. You're doing an event this week in Milwaukee. Can you tell us what it is?
Yes. This is our second Unity Makes Strength, which comes from the Haitian motto, L'Union Fait La Force, which is the motto on the Haitian flag. It's in honor of Haiti's Flag Day, which is actually May 18th. Our event is this Friday, May 13th. At 6 p.m. at the Peck Welcome Center at the zoo. And we will have Haitian food.
Oh.
We will have a Haitian market with locally made arts that mostly come from Dushiti. And we will have a silent auction with just some amazing things that people have donated. We'll have local music by One Drum. So we hope to have dancing and a little bit of DJ by Francie. So we'll have a chance to do some Haitian compa dancing.
I will play the drum also.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds fun. And it's what time?
6 p.m.
6 p.m.
And I would be glad to entertain any stragglers, latecomers, if they would like to call me at
614-659-6973. And you can find out more information on the web about Youth Haiti.
Yeah.
Did I get the address?
I wanted to point out that Youth Haiti is spelled with one H. Sometimes people look it up. So it's youthaiti.org.
Okay. Thank you both very much for being with us. All the best to you. And all the best.
Thank you.
It's a long road.
Thank you. But I want to add something before we finish. about I want the Milwaukee's people understand our realization, our work in Haiti, Youth Haiti. I want they understand that because Haiti has many problems now, Youth Haiti, with Gigi Pomerantz help and continues to help.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Again, that event is this Friday starting at 6 o'clock, and go to youthhaiti.org for more information, or that number is 414-659-6973. We'll put all the information on our Facebook page as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We're getting close to 2,000 Facebook members, too, and once we reach that, Rhonda knows this. We're going to do a book giveaway as we do because we have a lot of books and we have an audience that loves books and it's a fun thing to do. So we're getting close to 2,000. News is coming up momentarily from National Public Radio and we'll continue with our Wednesday conversation. So please stay with us on the Ideas Network.